Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
His soul stretched tight across the skies that fade behind a city block, or trampled by insistent feet at 4 and 5 and 6 o'clock. And short square fingers stuffing pipes and evening newspapers, and eyes assured of certain certainties. The conscience of a blackened street, impatient to assume the world. You came up with a great stat just now in the kitchen. You asked me a question. You asked me a cycling trivia question to which I didn't know the answer.
Oh, yes, I did. Who was the first American winner of Paris-Nice?
Well, I now know, but I'm going to leave a pause in the podcast now for the listeners to try and guess.
Bobby Julich.
Yeah.
My old teammate. My old flatmate. We lived together in Nice my first year pro.
No way.
Yeah, fact.
In Nice?
In Nice. That's my first year pro. I lived in Nice. I hated it.
So yesterday I found out you played the trombone.
Yeah.
And now I found out you lived in Nice.
Yeah.
I didn't know you lived in Nice.
I lived in Nice for
a year. Where did you live in Nice?
Where did I live in Nice? Kind of just, I can't describe it.
Well, but you and Pete, they've never had the sort of Nice banter.
Why? Because I don't banter about Nice. I didn't really like it.
Why didn't you like Nice?
There are a few reasons. Starters of riding wasn't very good unless you were doing epic inland rides. I know it was pretty spectacular. Otherwise, it was just traffic bonanza. And having to go out to Antibes and on these big main roads, etc. And then I was also dealing with, it was a bit like Housewives of US Postal, because it was the whole US Postal team had come to Cofidis, effectively Lance Armstrong, Frankie Andreu, Bobby Julich, Kevin Livingston, and they were all living in Nice. They'd all left Lake Como and come to live in Nice. And so there was always this drama, and Lance was there but not there, and still like the general, using the Jacques Anquetil term, of even though he was kind of out of the picture, he was still...
What year is this?
1997.
Mm-hmm.
And it just turned into this really weird clique, even with such a small amount of them, it turns into this really cliquey, weird thing. And I was like, I can't handle this. And so I left to go to Toulouse, where the Australians were, Stuart O'Grady.
Oh, yeah.
So I packed up my rental car at the end of 1997 to go to Toulouse.
Yeah.
Went to stay with Stewie. Got to Toulouse and I was like, oh man, this place is horrible.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm just going to carry on to Biarritz. So I just went to Biarritz and ended up on my own with no other pros. So yeah, that's how I ended up at Biarritz.
Did you know much about Biarritz before you went there?
No, I'd only been there once before.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, this place is beautiful.
Oh, so okay. Yeah. Yeah,
and the rest is history.
That must have been weird as hell. Like, yeah, the way you describe it almost sends shivers down my spine.
Yeah,
like Nice American set must have been.
It was pretty intense.
Really intense.
Because
Armstrong would be.
Bobby was sort of outside the bubble of the kind of Frankie and George and Lance thing.
Mm.
Kevin was like Lance's like little wingman buddy.
Right.
And Bobby, they just all kind of like tried to keep on the fringe of everything.
Yeah.
And so I was living with Bobby, who was just constantly traumatized by the fact that he was on the fringe of the rest of the group.
Yeah.
And then I'd ride with all of them, all best friends with each other, but there's a lot of bitching going on. It was genuinely, it was like living in a Big Brother show.
But Bobby Julich is not, I don't think I've ever met Bobby, but
Bobby's lovely.
But that's what I hear from everyone.
Yeah.
Like everyone, no one's got a bad word to say about Bobby Julich.
No, it's nothing bad about Bobby.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So he's in Greenville now.
First American winner of Paris-Nice.
Yeah. Can't give you the year. Maybe 98.
Mm.
Or maybe 99. I don't know. I'm not even going to
Well, in my in my I've got some facts for the podcast.
I'm looking forward to that. First of all, can you do this facts,
but I'm going to talk about another winner of Paris-Nice.
Okay, first, historical. How was Niels Pollitt's day in Neil Pollitt's voice? Your caricature of Niels Pollitt.
So, so my job today is to I must get over this hurd climb, and then I hit the front and I go very hard all of it, first and last climb. And that's what he did, didn't he?
That's exactly what he did.
Yeah, day after his 30th birthday.
Things, a little treat to himself. So what are your stats? Or your stories?
Well, they all relate. They all relate somehow to... oh, no, before I get on to that, I've got a slight bone to pick with you about what happened after the podcast yesterday.
This was not my fault.
What was it? When we set off... I think I said to you something like, can we go super slow?
And I said yes.
Right.
And we did.
But then there's always this thing of like, what's, when you're riding two of you and it's obviously a mismatch. You're on the Brompton. I was on this very heavy, very heavy, David.
Okay.
Commuter bike.
Yeah.
Is it easier to be sitting on the wheel of someone who's going slightly too fast for you or to actually be on the front?
And be on the front.
It's easier to be on the front.
Yeah.
But then... the problem with being on the front with you on my wheel is I kind of go a bit too hard.
That's exactly... So, yeah, so...
So I did it to myself.
Yeah, you did it to yourself. But and then you always have this habit, which was corrected pretty early on, of stopping at traffic lights in a big gear and then having to do like a 200-metre wind-up.
No, I got one wrong. Or did I get more than one
wrong? You got more than one wrong. That's just your habit of like doing these big wind-ups, which is like grinding. Also, hugely inefficient.
You ruin your chain ring by doing that, don't you? Yeah. That's where you kind of like... wear down.
And you look like you're trying, when you are trying to kind of get it going again. And I was just looking at you going, what are you doing, Ned? And then, yeah, you do push on a bit. So, you know, you've made your own bed.
Yeah. Well, it just got faster and faster. We rode from Ealing down, for those of you who know London, down through Brentford. We crossed over Kew Bridge and then down those kind of roads that lead to the South Circular and then over to...
Richmond Park.
Yeah, then along the South Circular for a bit through Sheen, and then we turned, and that was the moment. Oh, and you turn right,
that little hill
Sheen,
out of Sheen,
and
it's
the little hill, and that's when you started to go quite hard. That's when I was just holding on. We got to the gates, and then I was begging for you to go left because I knew I had to go straight on. I thought, David, he's
and
going
that goes
to
uphill again,
and then
it?
You went straight on, and then you went, you going this way? And I went, yeah. Because so am I. And I went, oh no, because it's at the top of the hill where the Royal Ballet School is.
And which I thought was the Royal Dart School.
Oh yeah, we had that slight, yeah.
Dance, you said dance.
I said
the
ballet
dance
or
school.
Dance. And you went, like, darts. And that went on for about three or four like iterations before the Royal Dart School.
I was like, what the hell?
Can you imagine that?
That's mad, yeah.
When I researched my darts book, there is no, I think I've said this to you before, there is no kind of actual history of darts because no one really knows where it came from. Or
really?
Well, they kind of do in bits and pieces. I established that it's probably a French fairground game. Actually, that's kind of where it comes from, really.
Really?
But there's all sorts of urban myths that have built up around. So if you read like, you know, like all the stuff that exists about the early years of the Tour de France that is actually not really true.
Yeah.
Like...
The assassin.
Like the assassin story, which is actually very questionable, whether or not Octave Lapize actually said that at all, or whether it was just an invention of the reporters on the day. But then there's stuff that, there's the kind of folklore that builds up around the early tours that is actually just nonsense. Mm. Like, for example, this is one of the first things I ever found out about the Tour de France, and I probably believed it for about 3 years before Rendalero said, yeah, it's not true, is it? But I loved the story. That the early riders used to put a stake down their shorts.
Oh, as a chamois.
As a chamois. And of course they'd sweat and they'd tenderize it and then they'd take this, this nonsense, take the steak out of their shorts and get to the hotel. They'd wash it under a tap and then get it fried up for their dinner.
Nice.
Because it had been tenderized and marinated throughout the day.
Oh my gosh.
I believed that.
That's good.
But if you go to kind of like homemade, homespun websites about the Tour de France, you'll see that story quite often getting kind of rehashed. Okay. And I think, fair enough, outsiders don't really know. And they kind of say, a lot of people take that face value. The darts equivalent of that, not dance, darts equivalent of that, is that Henry VIII gave Anne Boleyn a set of darts and a dartboard.
Oh, really?
And you know, on most history of darts websites, that story gets rehashed. It's nonsense.
It does seem nonsense.
Just made up.
Yeah.
Why did I start saying that? Oh, the royal connection. The royal school of darts.
Yeah.
That doesn't exist.
No. Okay.
And then we got to the cafe, and I went right, and I said, see ya. And I honestly, I just ground to a complete halt.
Did
so
you?
It's like, basically, what I'm saying is, I was really tired yesterday, and then it was a really hard half an hour at the end of the day of riding through.
And then you had a ride in this morning, and we were talking about this because you said you had an amazing, like, perfect tailwind.
This is interesting.
And I said, oh, I bet that gave you mixed emotions.
Completely.
But it wasn't mixed emotions. You said it was just absolute. You couldn't even enjoy the tailwind because you knew it would be a headwind on the way home.
But it's really interesting you picked up on that straight away because you obviously feel the same.
Yeah, it is. It is mixed emotions when you have a tailwind and
the first
you know
half
you've got to go back again.
Yeah.
Just got to live in the moment and enjoy it, Ned.
Yeah, but that's the. See, the other thing along similar lines is when we get to, and I think I've had this conversation with you before, when, like, do you remember the weather we had at the Tour of Britain last year in September?
The beautiful weather.
It was
like the Mediterranean summer.
32 degrees, wasn't it? And every day was just uninterrupted sun.
And you couldn't enjoy that, could you?
Couldn't enjoy it because I know that it's not promising to lead to anywhere. It's not like, oh, October's going to be even nicer. And November's going to be glorious high summer. You just know that it's like the last flickering of summer. And I hate winter. It's the last flickering of summer. And actually, so I couldn't enjoy that.
In search of melancholy. That's what you are.
Or just plagued by melancholy. It's like my shadow rising to meet me. That's a T.S. Eliot quote.
Is it? Yeah. Have we got T.S. Eliot today?
Yeah, we've had some T.S. Eliot.
Oh, good.
There's an amazing quote by T.S. Eliot.
Is it?
I know this is double Eliot. This is double Elioting this particular pod, but it's relevant.
Okay.
It's from the beginning of The Wasteland. I was reading it at home the other day. Where's the Wasteland? Sorry, get there in the end. Where's the Wasteland? Wasteland, Portrait of a Lady. Where's the Wasteland, David?
I don't know. I can't help you.
Wait, here we go. Notes, right, What the Thunder Said. I'm getting there. It's quite a long poem. I'm just going to move to the front. Burial of the Dead. So it starts with the famous line, April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. Blah, blah, blah. Jump on, and where is it now? Yes. What are the roots that clutch? What branches grow out of this stony rubbish? Son of man, you cannot say or guess, for you know only a heap of broken images where the sun beats and the dead tree gives no shelter, the cricket no relief, and the dry stone no sound of water. Only there is shadow under this red rock. Come in under the shadow of this red rock, and I will show you something different from either your shadow at morning striding behind you or your shadow at evening rising to meet you. I will show you fear in a handful of dust.
That was you on your ride in this morning.
Yeah, but I have melancholy pursuing me. Like my shadow at morning striding behind me and my shadow at evening rising to meet me.
There you go, Ned.
That's it. And that's also what the wind is doing to me.
Because it was in
my back this morning behind
me. And now it's coming in front of me.
And that's rising to meet me.
It's heavy.
Elliot, mate.
Yeah, it's just on it.
Should we talk about the bike race?
Yeah, it was interesting. Ineos Grenadiers, chapeau. Well, let's not even talk about the brakes. That's just no point, I don't think.
No.
Ineos Grenadiers took it to the race with about 60k to go, ripped the peloton to pieces on the final big climb, clearly invigorated by Egan Bernal's progressive comeback.
Yeah,
and it was really good riding, actually.
I would also say that, you know, Bernal gave that really interesting interview that some of you may have heard that Daniel did a couple of days ago where he said, I was caught in two minds. I was indecisive because I don't trust my own form. I don't know where my own form is. I feel certain things, but I don't know. And I didn't know whether I should find out. Well, today they clearly said, let's find out.
Yeah.
It's a day to find out, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer was what? It was...
Good.
Yeah,
I mean, good. I mean, Carlos Rodriguez was behind him. So, completely. You know, he's out and out leader of that team and racing really well. And he was there on the... So then it got to the final climb and it was in a little bit of disarray coming into it. Very steep, 1.5K, 2Ks, K super steep. And it had already whittled down, the peloton had rejoined. And it wasn't clear who was going to take the lead. Sudal Quickstep, we were all presuming it's going to be Remco show.
Yep.
He's going to launch pad,
yep.
Up the climb, yep. Then it's like another 10Ks of going up, sprint, drop down to the finish, Remco all over.
And at that point, it had been perfect, hadn't it? Because
his team didn't have to do anything.
Catania and Ilan Poulidor.
Ineos Grenadiers had made the race so hard, and then UAE had
UAE
also
took
done
over,
it. And
so Sudal had done nothing.
And then coming into the climb, Catania hit the front, Ilan Van Wilder shook his head, couldn't do anything. And then it cut away, And then next shot we had, Bora Hansgrohe had just exploded the out the front.
Yeah. And Roglic made the race there.
And it kind of, it selected all the GC leaders were up there, almost no domestiques. And there was a little lull once they all grouped. And Remco had to, he couldn't react to Primoz Roglic. He had to peg it back.
Yep.
Pegged it back, brought the, that group of GC racers back into it. It was about 10 of them. And the little lull, Jorgensen went with like a K to go from the top of the climb.
Yep.
And then that extend the lull continued, and McNulty and Skelmos came out and got across from him eventually, and then that was it. But then it was really strange because Remco kind of was clearly very strong, but didn't have the explosive kind of ability to make the difference, or didn't even try once. So he just got on the front and limited it and held it 10 seconds for a long time. Roglic helped him. Vlasov helped him. Jay Vine, who was the UAE rider behind, there was only three teams that had more than one rider at the front of the race. UAE, Bora Hansgrohe, and Decathlon, AG2R Le Mondial. Bora Hansgrohe were fully invested. You kept questioning that, rightfully. I mean, he's so far off GC, stage win was gone. They're limiting the damage for what? Is he going to go and ride away and take a minute on the climb tomorrow? Unlikely, Primoz Roglic. But they raced well.
Yeah.
They raced really well. But one thing did not change, and it was Remco Evenepoel. He was always in the front three of that group of 10, 12 riders.
Yep.
And never showed frustration.
Yeah.
Just kept going. And Jay Vine just sat in third wheel or second wheel or fourth wheel.
Yeah.
No one was questioning that either.
Yeah.
Everyone just sat on and let Remco and Bora Hansgrohe do all the work.
Yeah.
And then at the end, and Luke Plapp was there. He'd ridden a great race, but he didn't do anything until 5Ks to go.
No, he just did one turn on the front.
And
could have done a bit more, maybe.
And then Remco, I'm just talking about the back, we'll get to the front, but Remco even coming up, they came in 1 minute behind the group of McNulty, Skelmos, and our old boy. I've already forgotten who the third guy was.
Jorgensen.
Yeah. Jorgensen and McNulty were obviously massively, we're looking at the moment, McNulty in the yellow jersey, who's taken the lead.
Yep. Back in yellow.
So Jorgensen and McNulty were driving it, knowing that they were riding themselves up into top two and GC.
Yep.
Skelmos are 1 minute 27 down at the start of the day.
He was almost apologetic, wasn't he, Skelmos, in the interview just seen about, like, I know it was, I was just exploiting.
And he was
the
saying that they were stronger than me.
Yeah, it didn't look like that.
But 5Ks to go, Skelmos played the stage card and the off GC card and just sat on the back.
And then just pumped
and just pumped them in sprint. Them. Absolutely destroyed them. But Remco then continued, led the group in with like a K, 2Ks to go, just was on the front the whole way, and then just rode everyone off his wheel to the finish line.
Yeah, 300, 400 metres to go.
Like,
just went,
what the hell?
And so, that looked for the first time like he had lost a bit of composure in a positive sense. He looked a bit angry as he crossed like, in that sprint. Didn't
that was
he?
An angry just
that
ride
was
in the
kind
front.
Of,
yeah. But it goes to show you, that's what was confusing, because you don't do the amount of riding he did in those final 30Ks and then just ride everyone off your wheel in the final 300, 400 metres.
Right.
So he was mentally strong, but maybe just doesn't have that pure top end yet that kind of can make that gigantic difference that he and we are accustomed to.
Meanwhile, in Italy, Jonas Vingegaard has just, well, we didn't see the end, so actually I don't know, should I just double check what happened?
Have a quick look.
But I mean, when we were watching,
28 Ks to go, he attacked.
Yeah. At Tirreno on a kind of similar looking stage, wasn't
it? Well, that was confusing, so we were watching both again, and they actually looked like exactly the same race.
Literally. Yeah, Vingegaard won by 1 minute and 12 seconds from Ayuso. And is he now in the jersey or what? He must be, right?
Yeah. He was only 26 seconds down at the start of the
day. There you go. So he would have been like watching Paris-Nice highlights going,
Yeah, well, that would have been easy.
Oh, Tour de France looks like it's going to go my way.
I know. I mean,
there's the old boy, the Slovenian, sitting in a hotel somewhere, not racing at the moment, going,
That would have been fun.
Yeah. But old Remco does look like, well, on the evidence of today, it's just a bad, but as I said, I think in commentary, it's his first bad day in 2024.
And it's a Remco bad day.
It's a Remco bad day, which anyone else is pretty amazing.
Like, yeah, it was an amazing ride.
But I do think, I was trying to remember now, Soudal Quickstep have signed Mikel Landa.
Yeah.
Which is weird, isn't it?
What's which is weird because really he's like weird. Mr. Hit and Miss.
Yeah, but I mean, such a talent. I mean, they do need someone like Landa if he's got his head in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
They need someone like that. Probably need two or three Landers.
Yeah.
Have they got anyone else? I mean, his team is going to be notably weaker, whatever constellation they bring to the Tour de France.
Yeah, because even today, they didn't have to do anything. It was all just, they didn't have, you do need that world-class winner who's a domestique to set up a Remco.
Yeah.
You know,
UAE's just got a team full of them.
Yeah, and which they showed today.
Yeah.
Apart from Almeida, who missed it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, well, when you consider UAE are doing the same thing in Tirreno, yeah. The depth they have is wild. Yeah. Because they were the ones at the front of the race.
Isaac del Toro.
Toro is a
good
weapon.
Name that is, as
isn't
well.
It? It's really good. Where's he from?
Mexico.
Ah, nice. Oh, yeah, remember? I know that.
One of our 19,
yeah, one of our 19,
one of our 19
UAE
nationalities.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
including Poland, which is just a fringe, sort of minor European country.
Not minor, not core central, geographically central.
Yeah. Yeah, oh God. Would have been good to hear Christian Van der Velde and Bob Rolls' commentary on Paris-Nice.
I know.
They're commentator for NBC. American. So American now, the top two on GC. Mario Jorgensen is from Boise, Idaho.
Is he?
And McNulty's Texan, but I can't remember where he comes from in Texas off the top of my head.
No, I have no idea.
I want to say Tucson, but that's in Arizona, isn't it? No,
it's in Arizona.
So I don't know.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Yeah, he's a Texan.
So what are we going to talk about Paris-Nice? Your stories.
Well, it was just a Finnish town. Ah. Village. Looks beautiful. It's very near Antibes and Nice and places. You would have probably trained. You would have gone up these climbs.
So now that I'm figuring out.
With your terrible memory, you just probably can't remember.
No, I'd remember if I saw it.
On the other hand, it looks like a.
So we were playing this game. How much would you have to be paid to live in one of these French villages?
Well,
in northern France.
Yes, that's right. On stage
like
one.
Abysmal places.
Yeah.
Like just godforsaken lost towns and
villages.
Yeah,
the deal was, so I said to you, and it was a miserable Paris-Nice day on stage one or two, wasn't it? And we went through this one of those dreadful towns in Yvelines that is just built up on a main road.
Yeah, like the Marie-Celeste.
It just looked really grey and bleak. And I said to you, here's the deal. You've got to live in there.
Mm-hmm.
You can't leave the village.
Mm-hmm.
You can't leave the bounds of the village.
Yeah,
you can go out of the flat, maybe down to the shops and then come
down
back
to the bakery. But there probably wouldn't be one.
The bakery probably wouldn't be one. You've got to live there for an entire calendar year on your own. Mm. And you said actually a bit of you would quite enjoy it.
Yeah,
but you'd want paying.
I'd want paying.
So I said, "What's your price?"
And we just went through numbers until we got
numbers.
To the numbers.
And what did you settle on?
I think it was
£200,000.
Yeah.
You'd do it for £200,000?
Yeah.
If a mysterious benefactor appeared and just said, I want to pay David.
And you wouldn't do it for like 600?
750,000.
750, you'd do
it. I wanted £750,000.
Which is just madness.
But by the time we got to, what's it called? La Colle-sur-Loup today, I dropped my asking price markedly.
You went to £3,000.
£3,000.
And actually, then you said, actually, I'd pay.
It looked beautiful, didn't it?
So is this place we're talking about a bit like that?
It looked beautiful. I've suddenly been reminded, actually, talking about social experiments. I'll get onto my facts in a second, but of the BBC drama that I've finished and that you're listening to.
I've got two more episodes left, which I'll listen on my commute back today.
The Warlow experiment. It's
brilliant.
Well, it's just fun, isn't it?
It is just fun. West Country.
Yeah, it's based on a true story, isn't it? I think.
I was going to ask you that.
I think it is.
It seems so mad that it must
Well, I think that all the interrelationships, I think they're all complete fiction.
Yeah.
But I think your man existed.
Yeah.
The two central protagonists. So it's all about, some of you will have heard, if not, give it as a listen. It's a lot of fun. And it raises some quite interesting ideas as well.
Mm.
But it's about a early 19th century. Yeah.
No, late.
Oh, no, late. That's right, because he's going to come out in the 19th century.
1890.
But he goes in the 1890s. Exactly. A very late 18th century scientist who's a bit of a Salieri figure in the sense that he's not Mozart, he's Salieri. So he's not a great scientist.
He's just a classic Victorian keen amateur.
Yeah, and he's Yeah, and he wants to write a scientific journal that the Royal Society will, you know, gain mm-hmm. him admirers and fame and recognition, because he's suffering from a midlife crisis, basically. Mm-hmm. So he wants something for posterity.
And botany's not doing it for him.
So he designs this experiment called the Resilience of the Human Mind.
Something like that.
Where he takes a peasant from the village, offers him and his family riches for the rest of their lives mm-hmm. if they fulfill the terms of the experiment, where they take John Warlow, mm-hmm. the peasant in question, and he has to live underground in an excavated cellar underneath his big house without any daylight and without any human company or contact for 7 years. Mm. And if he fulfills the terms of that, then he can come out and be released after 7 years.
And £50 for life.
£50 for life, which is obviously a huge amount of money. Mm. And stuff goes wrong.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's got a lot of fun.
It's really good
fun.
And
the actor, I don't know who the actor is, but he has to do about 27 different accents.
Yeah. And when he got to the first woman, that took me off guard.
Yeah, because he's got quite a deep voice, the actor. Yeah. And some of the accents are West Country. So you start listening and it's like, good morning, Mr. So-and-so, said Catherine. Yeah. What, Catherine's talking like that?
So good.
The Warlow experiment, I recommend it. Today's International Women's Day, by the way, David.
Ah, yes.
Have you sent a message home to Nicole?
I haven't. No? I should do. I will do.
Yeah, and to all of our listeners, our many female listeners.
We do have many female listeners.
Happy International Women's Day. And hats off and chapeau to all of you. Before I get onto my facts, this is a stat courtesy of Pro Cycling Stats, right? How many career King of the Mountain sprints has Thomas de Gendt won at Paris-Nice?
Oh, 23.
45?
What? That's wild.
Isn't that wild? I think it's an amazing statistic. Second best was Thomas Verclaire with something like 23 or something. Huh. 45.
That's Thomas mad. De Gendt.
Right. You know, on Wikipedia sites, so I did go to the Wikipedia site of La Colle sur Loup, they sometimes have notable residents.
Yes.
Yeah. Four from La Colle sur Loup, all with quite interesting biographies. One was a man called Jean-François Maxime Rebaud, who was born in the Château de Canadelle in this little hilltop town, La Colle sur Loup. He was born in 1795.
Oh,
Warlow experiment time.
Yeah.
Pretty much exactly.
I was 18.
No, 1795.
Oh, 17, yeah. Yeah. This is 17, right.
He was born in 1795 and he died in 1894 at the age of 99.
Wow.
Which is a hell of an age at that time in human history. And he was an officer in the French army who fought and wrote an account and a memoir of the Greek War of Independence.
Holy moly.
Didn't know what the Greek War of Independence was, so I had a little look at that.
Yeah.
And of course they were fighting for independence from the Ottomans, okay, in the early 19th century. And the war lasted from 1821 to 1829 when they won independence.
Holy moly.
So it was an 8-year war, but the tipping point was when the British, the French, Napoleon, and the Russians joined in on their side in 1826, and that tipped the balance in their favour. And Greece became free of the Ottoman rule.
So the decline and fall of the Ottoman Empire, basically. Yeah.
And he was a big part of it. Jean-François Maxime Rebaud, I thought that was relatively interesting, simply because it informed me about a conflict I knew nothing about.
It's very good to know.
Isn't it? Cycling, right?
Yeah.
It's what it does.
Mm-hmm.
It's great, isn't it? And this guy, this is more maybe up your street, although you like a bit of history, so that was, but this will appeal to you. Bernard Marie François Alexandre Colomb Clerc.
Great name.
What a name that is. Born 1960, oh no, don't know when he was born. Oh no, 1940 he was born. And he was active in his sport from 1961 to 1963. He was a racing driver.
Ooh, very cool.
And he raced Cooper cars.
Did he?
What, I've never
Frenchy
heard, of, I've never heard Cooper. Of Cooper cars.
Are they one of the great British racing houses, Cooper? Stables? Yeah, Mini Cooper.
Yeah, but that's a Mini.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, they get prepped up by a racing kind of factory to basically rebrand them and tune them up. So Cooper was a racing manufacturer, like Lotus or Caterham do their things as well.
Okay.
Or back in the day, you had so many British like racing manufacturers that we've never heard of.
Yeah.
Well, Cooper's definitely one we've heard of. Oh, you race for Cooper? That's rare for a Frenchie to drive for a British.
I don't think he's terribly good.
They bought it then, probably.
His best place, this is just straight off the top of my head, I'm not even looking at the notes. Look at my eyes.
Yeah.
His best place finish was in the Grand Prix of Vienna. He finished fourth in the Formula One circuit.
Well, that's not bad, is it?
Well, that's all right. Okay. Then there is, now this young man is still alive. He's 79 years of age. A French writer called Daniel Pennac.
Mm-hmm.
Who lives in La Colle-sur-Luna, and he had an amazing childhood. He was born in Casablanca in Morocco, but grew up in various different postings, a bit like you, all around the French colonial sphere. Mostly in Africa, but also in like Martinique and places like that. Because his old man was a general in the French army.
Holy moly.
And so he had this kind of like really extraordinary upbringing. And he's been a writer now for many, many years. Only one of his books has ever been translated into English. I had a little look at it and quite appeals to me. It's called, appropriately enough, L'Œil du Loup, The Eye of the Wolf.
Oh.
And Loup is the name of the river, the river Loup that they race down towards the finish line that gives its name to La Colle-sur-Loup. I think that's just coincidence. Now, this book has been translated into English as The Eye of the Wolf, and you can get it.
What's it about?
It's a kind of children's book. Be one for your kids.
Yeah.
A perfect age for it, I think. Yeah. It's a poignant allegory of love and trust between a wolf and a boy.
Oh, that's lovely.
Who form this kind of bond.
Oh, that's lovely.
It sounds absolutely brilliant. It's got a foreword by Michael Morpurgo, who's one of the great, you know, children's book writers. Yeah. So you should buy that.
I'll look it up.
In memory of Stage 6 of the
Yes.
Tony. Yeah?
Yeah.
And bring it home. In fact, I'll try and get it for you.
Okay, thank you, Ned.
All right. And finally, Jean-Pierre Tessier. He's 80 years of age, still alive. Was a footballer. And he was a defender, and he played in the late 1960s and early 1970s starting off at AC Ajaccio from Corsica.
Yeah.
And then played into League One teams, Reims, Grenoble, Nice, and Avignon. And then he moved into politics. I'm not sure which party he represented. It wasn't one of the obvious ones. Although French political parties are quite strange because they come and go a bit, don't they? It's not like the Conservatives and Labour.
No.
Because you get like parties that... Like Macron's party.
National Front,
You got the National Front as well. I don't think he's a National Front politician. Anyway, his son is called Antonin, and he is 46 years of age, Antonin, or around about that age, and he is known as the Pavarotti of poker. And he, a couple of years ago, won the World Championships of poker in Las Vegas.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a big deal.
I guess so. I think he's one of the best poker players in the world. Antonin, huge guy.
That's why he's Pavarotti, he's just big. He's big.
Massive, long hair, quite a girth on him. If we were looking at his pro cycling stats page, he'd be 180-something.
Wowzers.
And weight-wise...
Easy triple digits.
Easy triple digits. Yeah, deep into triple digits. So unlikely to really sort of like...
Proper chap.
Yeah. And that was that. And they are the Tessier family... distantly related to a rider of the late 1940s, early 50s, called Lucien Tessier, who won four stages of the Tour de France between 1947 and 1954. In 1946, Tessier finished second to Fausto Coppi at Milan-San Remo.
Wowzers.
In 1945, the previous year, he finished second in Paris-Roubaix. I don't know to whom. And in 1951, he finished second overall at Paris-Nice. And there's a connection. And won two stages in his career at Paris-Nice. And that year he finished second to a Belgian rider called Roger de Kock. Who I'd never heard of.
No. Good facts, Ned.
There's my facts.
Really good facts.
Happy with that?
Very happy with that. I think we'd be quite struggling to find a British village with such diverse characters.
No. Probably you're right. Ilkeston, D.H. Lawrence. I bet Ilkeston's got quite a few.
Ilkeston, maybe.
I don't know why I suddenly thought of Ilkeston. But, that's about it. Now, shall I have a little dabble at our Twitter and see if we've got any more...
Oh, yeah, do that.
See if we've got any more interesting merch ideas. Let's have a little look. There was one that somebody replied to, that's really niche, this, they admitted. But I would buy, he said, something to do with Ferraris parked outside Selhurst Park.
Nice. I watched the film Ferrari last night.
Did you?
Yeah, it's very good.
Why? Give me a quick film review.
It's about Enzo Ferrari and basic biography of him in his later years. And it's around the 1957 Mille Miglia.
What's the Mille Miglia again?
It's a road race, so an open roads from Brescia in northern Italy down to Rome and back up again.
Right.
1956, Stirling Moss won it.
Stirling Moss. And used to be the landlord to my friend Mel.
Did he?
Stirling Moss.
Yeah, really? He was a landlord to a lot of people, I think.
Yeah, Queenstown Road. And, it's a bit of a slum, to be honest.
Slumdog Millionaire.
Slumdog Millionaire.
No, it's really good because it was about Ferraris at breaking point, and as were Maserati, and had to win Mille Miglia to kind of increase their value to get investment. But it's more about his life and about behind the scenes. I didn't know he had a double family and things that.
It's not Ocatil behavior, is it?
Not as bad, but still not ideal.
Not straightforward.
No.
Glory of Wine on Twitter says, Jacques Anquetil, extraordinary might be one word for it. A few more come to mind. Fair comment. Random Female on International Women's Day says, late to the pod, but delighted to hear David's reason for playing the trombone. Long arms. Presumably, Jonathan Milan would be a trombonist too.
Yes.
Yes. Pete, I see, is an angelic triangle player. Cyclists as musicians needs further explanation by the wonderful Never Strays Far team.
That is a good one.
Yes, that is a
good one. I see Pete with a violin. Like doing one of those crazy violin solos where they move around a lot.
Brandon McNulty? Cello.
Cello. Nice. Remco Evenepoel.
Trumpet. Trumpet? Yeah.
Actually, yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah. Jonas Vingegaard? Oboe.
You're on this.
I'm totally on this. David Gaudu? Flute.
Primoz Roglic.
That's not so... Go on.
I got an easy one for you. Tadej Pogacar.
Guitar.
I was going to say drums.
Drums? What's Roggers, though? That's not... Oh, no, Roglic. French horn.
French horn, nice.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That was a great question, Random FEMA. Thank you very much. Pablo Blanco. Exactly what we're talking about. A very impressive outcrop. That's a geology one. Any more? Merch slogan. Right. Looking forward to... Right. Merch slogan. It's a baffler.
Baffler.
Not bad.
Not bad.
Not bad. Remerch ideas. How about a cycling cap? This is Hastings Blue. How about a cycling cap in Never Strays Far colours? Gives me a sort of La Vie Claire vibe. Yeah, could do that. Yeah,
quadrants.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I would definitely buy, this is Pete Summers, I would definitely buy a Pete's Thesaurus notebook. You should definitely have a t-shirt with a I Won the Pod rear print. There's some good ideas here. Haven't got into watching Sergio podcasts. Matt Legg, to where he won the... Haven't got into watching stage races yet this season, so I thought I would binge this week's Never Strays Far podcast to find out about Paris-Nice.
Good luck.
And unsurprisingly, despite listening to some wonderful discussions on various topics, I'm still none the wiser.
You're welcome.
Come on, Matt Legg.
Now we've done some good racing.
Brandon McNulty leads Paris-Nice with two stages to go.
Yeah.
From Matthew Jorgensen. They guess all you need to know. Scroll down, see what else. Partridge Thornton. Yeah, we go. And according to Wednesday's Never Strays Far, I inspired this poll, which I'm tragically thrilled by. That's true. Listening to at Ned Bolting on Never Strays Far the other day and his run-in with Brunel about armchair directors, I think Ned would appreciate this. This is Ian Dark, who's a football commentator. Thought I would share my favourite verbal crossfire on the radio. Don Reavy. You criticise my teams and tactics, but how many caps did you win, Brian? Esteemed football writer Brian Glanville. Don, you don't need to be a murderer to play Macbeth.
Oh,
boom.
Nice.
That is great. What a good reply. Yeah. And that's it. Okay. Pappy Yongjin. Remember Pappy Yongjin? Happy International Women's Day. I really liked the Tour de France West Side Story episode when discussing mechanics and Swannies. Maybe some riff on that. There's lots. There's too much. I'm slightly overwhelmed by the merch possibilities.
Yeah. We have to have a meeting. A round table.
A round table.
With Pete. Wherever Pete is.
Wherever Pete is in the world. Yeah. We'll try and get him on the pod soon. Mm. All right. See you tomorrow. We'll be right back.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.